Good afternoon. Thank you for... Can you hear me? Yes? Okay. All right. I just want to talk briefly for the next 15 minutes about police legitimacy and stop and search in the context of legitimacy. Basically, the point I want to make is that stop and search is an example of what Tom Tyler has called a teachable moment about police legitimacy. And as we would see shortly, that the fact of being stopped, searched, or arrested has a relationship with your views about the legitimacy of the police, but also the quality of the interaction that goes on during the stop and search can be important for police legitimacy. Okay, so we start briefly. Why is this issue of legitimacy important? For those of us who had the chance to listen to Sir Dennis O'Connell at the Leveson inquiry, he did make the point that this is an issue that is at the heart of policing, and that going forward, it's going to really be one of the really important issues to be taken seriously. Okay. What do we mean by police legitimacy? We don't mean the use of force or the ability to project fear or threat of punishment, but we're talking about judgments about the morality of power, whether power either in organizations, as Paul will talk about, or in the context of community views about criminal justice agencies. To what extent is that power recognized as being morally valid? There are different dimensions of this judgment. Briefly, there are judgments about the lawfulness of the power, the source and the manner in which that power is used, how effective the power is used in trying to achieve whatever objectives that the criminal justice agency is set to achieve. And also the issue of distributive justice, which is the allocation of police resources across different groups. Whether you're talking about policing of patrolling of different areas or different groups within a community. And of course, the one that we have a lot of research done on it is the issue of procedural justice. How fairly is the interaction between the police and members of the public? There are a number of issues there, which include, if you like, the quality of the decision-making during the interaction. Do we listen to, take representation from both sides? Do police officers come across as being neutral? Are they competent? Those judgments feed into procedural justice. And of course, the other issue about the quality of treatment that people receive. Are they shown respect? Are the reasons given for the decisions that are taken? Those are the important issues that feed into judgments about the legitimacy or otherwise of police institutions. Of course, there's been a lot of research, and Paul alluded to that earlier in the session, about the relationship between legitimacy and different aspects of public behavior. That judgments about police legitimacy are important in explaining compliance, in explaining public willingness to voluntarily provide information or intelligence, if you like, to police agencies. And there's also evidence that support for vigilante violence or self-help can be explained in part by judgments in relation to police legitimacy. Okay. But the really key thing I wanted to suggest, which is what I mentioned at the beginning, is the importance of the interactions or the encounters that members of the public have with police, that during these encounters, people are learning about all the issues that I mentioned earlier. We could talk in abstract terms about the lawfulness of policing, how policing is procedurally just or distributively just, or how effective policing is. But it is actually during the day-to-day encounters or interactions that people have with police agencies that they do learn about the legitimacy or otherwise of police institutions. Okay. And I want to suggest that stop and search is one of those, if you like, teachable moments. One of those moments that people will learn about the legitimacy or otherwise of police institutions or police officers. Of course, we all know about the various legal bases for stop and search. For the lack of time, I will not go into that. But of course, some of the headlines we often read about stop and search, a really contentious issue. Recently, reports in the media about police use of stop and search under Section 60, suggesting that there is this issue of disproportionality in the use of stop and search. That really is not the focus of my analysis. But just to say that sometimes these media reports do not really tell us much about the nature of stop and search. But briefly, if we look at analysis that my colleague Barak has done of 53,000 cases of stop and search in a particular police force, really interesting results from there. You see how the age distribution fits with, for those of us who are familiar with the age crime curve, this seems to mirror that very well. And also, again, a lot of discussion about why stop and search is often used. In this analysis, we see how most of the stop and search searches that are done result in no further action. It's only a few cases that result in arrest. Again, this is just to make the point that stop and search, it's much more complex than sometimes the issues that are conveyed in the media reports, okay? And this analysis from the data, which I think is really instructive, that most of the people who are stop and search are people already known to the police. Okay? Almost two-thirds of them are already known to the police. So are they just picking the usual suspects or otherwise? Okay. But again, linking back to the issue I mentioned earlier about teachable moments, because this, what this analysis seems to be suggesting is that to the extent that stop and search is a teachable moment, you've got, in many cases, less than or up to 10 minutes for people to learn about the legitimacy or otherwise of the police. Or you could say less than 5 minutes that people will learn about the quality of policing, will learn about the lawfulness, the justice, and the effectiveness of policing, which might then feed into their judgments about the legitimacy or otherwise of the police. Okay. Now I move on to a survey that was done in London by on behalf of the Met, by a private agency. Basically, the question I want to try to address with the survey is whether the fact of experiencing stop and search undermines legitimacy, and two, whether the quality of the interaction can have or can compensate for the fact of having been stopped or searched. Okay, I should say that the questions in the survey asked about being stopped, and then another one about being searched or arrested. There are no questions about stop and search. They're just about being stopped, being searched, or arrested. So I'm going to do the analysis along those lines. Of course, the response rate is 60%, not great, but I think for our purposes, it's just to illustrate the issues that I'm talking about here. And of course, I had no control over these matters. Okay. First of all, it's just to look at the ethnic distribution. Of course, these are in many ways crude measures of ethnicity. There are different subgroups within each case, but as you can see, the number of cases are not many to be able to break them down like that. Okay. Most of those who have been stopped in the last 12 months prior to the study were people of white background. Okay. So the key question here, the one that we started with, is whether being stopped and searched or being stopped affects legitimacy. And we can see from that graph clearly that the fact of being stopped seemed to have this negative impact on the legitimacy or judgments about the legitimacy of the police across the different ethnic groups. And then when we ask whether there was reason given for the stop, okay, we see that where if we restrict our focus just to those who had been stopped, when there is a reason for the stop, legitimacy seems to appreciate. But when there's people say, oh, not really, the police didn't quite give a reason for the stop, then legitimacy drops drastically. Okay. You can have the same for whether people were, thought they were treated with respect. A similar thing across the three ethnic groups, that not being treated with respect appears to be the key thing that's driving down perceptions of legitimacy among the group. The other point is about being stopped, being searched or arrested, and out of the 5,000 people who were interviewed, only 73 reported that they had been searched or arrested. And in fact, among those group, 18, almost 20% were those who reported that they had been stopped, for those who said they had been arrested. Okay, so we look at similar issues here. Again, whether there was a reason given appears to be important in shaping the legitimacy of the police across the three ethnic groups that we are looking at. Of course, I think the striking thing here, it's still yes and no. Yes, a reason fully given, and then not really. Those are the legend there. But what we find here is that we often think, I mean, if you look at the analysis that's often done about stop and search, we are told that people of ethnic minority have really negative views about the police. But we see here that the group with the lowest view of the legitimacy of the police were people of white background. But across the three groups, being given a reason for the stop is important in whether legitimacy appreciates or is driven down. And the last slide I want to talk about again is being treated with respect during the stop and search, during the search or arrest. And we see again that saying that, yes, a reason was fully, I was treated with full respect during the interaction is important. So I think the issue here is that it's often not necessarily the case that you being stopped, yes, being stopped has a negative impact on your views about the legitimacy of the police. But when the interaction is seen as being procedurally just, in other words, there are reasons given for the stop and search, people are treated with respect, those seem to compensate for the negative effects from the fact of being stopped, being searched, or being arrested. Okay? I think I made it 15 minutes. All right, thank you.
Hello, it's me again. Excuse me. So how do I get to the... Because someone just pointed me towards the, where the other presentations are. Sorry.
I think I've ruined it before. Let's try to close this. Is it one over here?
Yeah, that's it. Thank you. Phew. It's really helpful following Justice's presentation because I'm essentially going to be talking about how this model of procedural justice and fairness works internally within organisations. This is a piece of work that I've been working collaboratively with Gillian Porter from Durham Constabulary and Ben Bradford from Oxford University. Now, it's interesting because Tom Tyler's work on procedural justice, that's the thing that he's probably most famous for, but he's also done some work on how this works within organisations. And it turns out that there's actually a massive volume of literature within the occupational psychology world that where he took some of these original ideas from and translated them into a criminal justice setting. And so when we were doing our work on procedural justice, we wanted to take some of these ideas in the occupational psychology world and sort of look at them and see if they operated within police departments. And there's only a very small literature specifically on how these things work within police departments. So what does the organisational justice model look like? Well, it's very familiar, but it's sort of, there are some specific dimensions within organisations. And it essentially goes like this. It argues that perceptions of fairness are really important with organisations in the sense that they drive what's called organisational citizenship behaviours. So kind of positive attitudes and behaviours which will benefit the organisation. It also argues that those perceptions of fairness are actually more important than other sorts of incentives. And by that they mean sort of instrumental incentives, which you might traditionally get within disciplined organisations. So things like reward and recognition schemes, sanctions for getting things wrong, and other penalties. So those things that sort of make the cost of getting things wrong more expensive to you. So the theory suggests that treating people fairly will have a greater impact on those attitudes and behaviours than those kind of traditional incentives. Now, why should that be? Why should fairness have that greater impact? Well, the argument goes is that by being treated fairly by your supervisor and by senior leaders within an organisation, it sends out some very clear signals about your worth and value as a member of staff. So by being treated fairly by the group, it makes you feel part of the group and helps establish group norms. Now, I suppose the flip side of this is, I think, very compelling, is that if you're treated unfairly by a supervisor or by a senior leader, it sends out a very clear message, which is this, which is we as an organisation don't value you, and the rules that we want to apply by or work with don't apply to you. So some of the studies in the occupational psychology literature say that experience of unfair treatment can drive sort of perverse behaviours within organisations. So you might have stealing, you might have people covertly sabotaging what the organisation is trying to do. So these are kind of really important ideas to explore within the policing organisation. But what does organisational justice actually mean? Well, there seems to me from literature there are sort of two key components. You've got distributive justice, which as Justice pointed out, is that sort of sense of having a fair share of the resources or the fair share of the organisational pie. So that could be judged in terms of your work inputs, so how much work you do compared to your colleagues, whether you think that's fair, and the extent to which you think your inputs are rewarded fairly, perhaps in terms of your pay, perhaps in terms of the sort of other sort of rewards and recognitions that you might get within your organisation. Now, so there's a tricky thing here, is that who are people comparing them against? Well, we might assume it's people within your own organisation, perhaps someone from response or neighbourhood, but it could be wider than that. It could be bankers or MPs and other sorts of people. So we have to bear in mind that these are perceptions, and we're not entirely sure how they're making their assessments of whether they think their inputs and outputs are fair. The second element of organisational justice is procedural fairness, and this boils down essentially to two key concepts. So it's the fairness of decision-making within the organisation by supervisors and by senior managers in terms of the extent to which they explain the procedures that they will follow through decisions, the outcome of those decisions, and whether they involve you in that decision-making process and make you feel that you have some sort of influence. The second dimension is very much about the quality of interpersonal interactions, the extent to which you've been treated fairly by people and the extent to which you feel that they've treated you openly and honestly. Now, just reflect for a moment about how that situates with your traditional understanding of police organisation. You know, discipline and control, command and control, perhaps doesn't rest so well with this. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to explore some of these issues empirically. So Durham had just gone through an extensive organisational change programme. They wanted to carry out a staff survey, but they didn't want to spend any money on it, so they contacted the MPA to help them develop something new. We said that there was an opportunity here to test out some of these ideas. They were very keen on that, and so we went about redesigning their staff survey, starting with the theoretical ideas from Tyler and Blader, and really unpacking them and developing some questions that would really sort of measure those issues. The survey was administered online by Durham. Response rate was at 40%. might seem a bit low, but we've contacted some survey houses and they say that for staff surveys that's well within the sort of normal response rate territory. Now, for each sort of concept we were measuring, we had 3, 4, 5, 6 questions, which we scaled together using confirmatory factor analysis, and then we modelled the data using structural equation modelling, which Ben Bradford helped with. Now, this is the kind of theoretical model that we were sort of testing. So on the very far right-hand side, we have these positive work attitudes and behaviours, those organisational citizenship behaviours that we want, which we thought these sorts of ideas would encourage, and I'll talk about those when I talk about the results. Now, there are different pathways to getting to that positive behaviour, either through incentives, the fear of getting caught or being sanctioned or being held to account for doing something wrong, or Tom Tyler would argue that the alternative route is that it comes through identifying with the organisation that you belong to and that being very much grounded in these perceptions of fairness. Okay, so we did five different tests looking at 5 different sort of outcome variables. And the first one we looked at was discretionary effort. So this is the willingness of staff and officers to go the extra mile, not for their own benefit, but because they thought it would benefit others within the organisation. And what we see here is there's no link whatsoever from perceived risk of sanction towards that discretionary effort, which might come as a surprise to you. What we do see here is there's a very, very strong link from group identity, so identifying with the force and the organisation, and that willingness to do extra work. And that group identity in the centre of the graphic is being very much driven by perceptions of senior leaders acting fairly, and also distributive fairness and supervisory fairness, but mainly coming from organisational fairness. And in this particular model, we have a direct route from that perception of organisational fairness to discretionary effort. Now, I should briefly explain what those numbers represent. These are standardised correlation coefficients, and they go from -1 all the way through to +1. The ones represent sort of almost a perfect synergy. Zeros, there's sort of no relationship at all. So these are all moving in the right direction, and that 0.6 is a very strong relationship. Okay, the second model we looked at was feelings of empowerment. So we were asking people whether they felt confident to make work decisions or whether they felt able to innovate within the workplace. Again, no link from threat of sanction, but of all sorts of different relationships from group identity and from those individual elements of organisational justice. Our third model. So I suppose back to that last point. If you're wanting to move your force towards one that embraces professional judgment and discretion, well, maybe you have to think about how your internal structures work in terms of fairness. So to our third model, we asked people questions about their attitudes towards members of the public. Had some shocking results. But besides that, again, we see a very similar pattern as before. No link from risk of sanction to those positive attitudes about the public, but a very strong relationship between group identity being very much grounded in perceptions of fairness. So if you want to move your organisation to one that embraces a sort of service delivery and focuses on quality of service, well, maybe you have to think about your internal structures and how senior leaders and supervisors go about dealing with the front line. Now, the last two models are slightly different. Now, this is the outcome measure here is whether people stated they followed organisational rules, guidelines, and the instructions of their supervisors. Now, what we see here is there is a link from threat of sanction to people following rules. Perhaps that stands to reason, and I think maybe sort of organisational justice theory perhaps overstates the extent to which other forms of incentives don't impact on compliance, because we see here there still seem to be some sort of relationship. We don't see that link from group identity, which was a surprise to us. We're not entirely sure why. It's possibly because some of the measures in our outcome were about whether you followed your supervisor's instructions, and maybe group identity and supervisory compliance perhaps don't go together so clearly. But what we do see is that link directly from supervisory fairness through to compliance. So that's a reasonably strong association. So I think we're still saying that organisational justice is still really important to encouraging rule following. In fact, what's more important perhaps here is that the effect of supervisory fairness is almost twice that of risk of sanction. Now, one of the sort of key criticisms of organisational justice theory is that if you over-identify with your organisation, you can end up doing things which are quite sort of morally wrong, which you don't personally agree with, but you can feel compelled to do because your organisation sort of instructs you to do it. So we wanted to get into some of these ideas. And I'm not entirely sure we've got the language right here, but we asked some harder questions of the respondents. We asked them, would they do what they were asked by their supervisor, even if they thought it was wrong, or follow guidelines even when they thought it was wrong? Now, what we see here is that risk of sanction does seem to predict dull compliance, as we've called it. Now, that sort of stands to reason. So if you're being beaten up about your stop and search numbers, well, you might just go out there and stop and search someone without reasonable suspicion just to hit your target. So you can see that you might be compelled by those sanctions to do something that you think might be wrong. What we also see here is that supervisory fairness also predicts dull compliance. And we think here that what might be happening is that if you have a really good supervisor that looks after you, takes care of you, you might end up sort of walking on broken glass for them, perhaps doing things that they just instruct you to without reflecting on it. But what I should say here is that overall we're explaining much less variance in the data, and the effect of supervisory fairness on dull compliance is half that we saw in the last model. So overall I think we would say that supervisory fairness is more of a positive than a negative, if that makes sense. Okay, so what's happening next? We're extending our collaboration. We're now working with Derbyshire. We're working with Sir Tony Bottoms and Justice on some further analysis. We've carried out a second survey in Durham this year, slightly lower, slower response rate, but what we're trying to do is develop our understanding of what might be happening. So we're looking at many more outcome measures. These are the ones that seem to be moving in the right direction and follow the same sort of models that I've already described. So seem to be having a positive impact on feelings of well-being and all sorts of things around quality of service. One thing we do want to start looking at is developing Tony Bottoms and Justice's ideas around self-legitimacy. So we think there's some really good empirical testing we can do there. So what's the bottom line? I think basically by making fair decisions, explaining them to people and being respectful within your own organisation, you can encourage them to engage in positive work behaviours. This isn't just about being nice. This is about making hard decisions, but engaging people in them so they understand what it means to them. Organisational sanctions, of course, are important, but you have to use them appropriately so that they don't backfire on you. So they have to be perceived to be fair and don't encourage those perverse outcomes that we might have seen. And this is a great quote that Mike Huff has used a few times, which basically says that it's very easy to lose trust of people, but very difficult to build up over time. So that sense of unfairness that people might feel within their organisation, if things go wrong, can be very difficult to build back. And as I said before, unfairness does represent a significant organisational risk. Now, I suppose as this session is about sort of diagnostics with evidence-based policing, I suppose there are a couple of things here that are really important. Firstly, these become things that you can now develop interventions for and that you can test within a sort of an RCT environment. But also, if you're implementing an RCT, how are you going to get them to follow the protocols that you've set out? Well, engage them. Treat them fairly, explain them what you're doing. So, you know, there's some things here about implementation which I think are really valuable. Thank you.
Cool, thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everybody. Got to thank Professor Sherman for his sense of humour, putting somebody who was expelled from school on after two academic doctors. This should be rich. Thank you for that. You crazy American.
You weren't expelled from Cambridge.
No, this is true. This is true. Indeed. It's a pleasure to be here, and I will rattle through this in 15 minutes, I promise. I've been asked to talk about the thesis that I did. It's basically a study about assaults on police officers in Merseyside. It's a five-year study. I'll rattle through why the study was done and what the findings are, and some of that's statistical, but most of it really is very practical stuff, really. As soon as I work out this thing, of course. There we go, got it. Yes, thank you for that, Justice. See what I mean? Right, Merseyside Police, this is where I work. It has got a reputation nationally of being quite a violent place. We do have guns and gang problems. And what was of real interest to me was what is the actual threat to officers in Merseyside? Because the perception and the reality, as we know in policing, are not always the same. I was really interested to take an evidence-based approach to see what we could learn from really the information that we already had at our fingertips. So that's really how the study commenced. You know, far too often we see media headlines, and I've just picked out just a few recent ones. You know, Suffolk, assaults on officers in Suffolk up by a third on the BBC. Again, 3,500 assaults in North Wales. I think actually that was the whole of Wales. And this one caught my eye in the Metro. The police officers assaulted every 20 minutes. And clearly the tragic events of this week in Essex, you know, are all too real. These headlines do nothing to actually erode public confidence and make fear of crime, in my view, increase. So that they were the interesting factors, really, for me to sort of get involved in this study. Thankfully, Dr. Tankerby has covered legitimacy for me, which is very good of him. But I also think this is really important to the study because policing by consent is something that we really hold dear to British policing. The minimum use of force, it's really important for us. And every interaction with members of the public is a teachable moment. And it was the same in my study in Merseyside, really. I like this little note from Wraith, 1956, the historic tradition that the police are the public and the public are the police really does, to me, hold true and still today. And that's really what's at the heart of the study, if you like. This is an image, and this is probably what people think about when they're thinking about use of force or assaults on police officers. Not everybody buys into the concept of policing by consent, and not everybody understands that, both police officers and also members of the public. So my study looked at lots of different ways that police officers are assaulted, and I've just picked out a few, really. Traffic management, again, a lot of US studies have shown that, you know, traffic stops are actually a high proportion of where assaults come from. So I was interested in trying to get a more rounded picture. So I won't go through all of these, but that was basically where I was looking at. Even use of police protection powers where we take children into care carry risks of assaults on officers. Again, don't worry, it's not a load of quotes and stuff, but just some of these are very important, I think, to the study. This is a study of Richard Johnson. If you've got a moment, I would recommend you reading this. This is about a predictive study about assaults on police officers attending domestic violent incidents. It's a really interesting, I think it's interesting. Perhaps when the synchronised swimming's on during the Olympics, you might want to pick up the article then. It's a good time. But it is, it's an unpredictable nature, policing is, it's unpredictable and we don't know what's going to happen. But is it an occupational hazard that you get assaulted? And that's the question I was asking myself prior to the study. Okay, so Merseyside. It was a 5-year study, 2006 to 2011. We used in-house secondary data. I'll explain what we used in a second. And basically that came to 4,545 assaults on officers. And again, I'll go into some more details in a second. And that involved 2,333 officers. There's a lot of repeat assaults on officers within that, which is the crux of the findings, really. 2,333 officers is about 57% of my force size. If the cuts keep going the way they're going, it might be 100%. Well, that's just a political jab there, in case anyone's in. Data accuracy. Right. These are all the data issues that I had to face and try and get over. Accuracy was the biggest thing. I started out with 17,500 assaults in the 5-year because they've been incorrectly put into the system or they've used terms which my computer search was picking up on, and that whittled its way down. Crime recording has greatly improved with national crime recording standards. In terms of how accurate we are now. That is definitely the case, but within all of that, we're still not capturing key things like alcohol and drugs misuse. I'm talking about the assailants now, not the officers, but that's the sort of thing we're not capturing. So to actually get to the characteristics of the problem, not easily achieved. Human resource database, again, for me, I was halted at a point. I wanted to know what the academic state of people. Officers who were assaulted, you know, had they got degrees, what were the qualifications, and our database couldn't capture that. We don't know what we should know about our staff, so that was an issue. And health and safety, I don't know whether you're aware, but a lot of the figures the Home Office get each year about assault on officers come from the health and safety databases of each force, and ours is not accurate, and so the figures we've been pumping out, it's just not accurate. We're missing things, so, you know, it was an issue for me. Complaints and litigation, I'll explain why that was such an important area for me in a second. And fundamentally, all of these are standalone systems. So it's a key issue in any research that I needed to... It took a long time to get accurate data. The relevance of the study, well, there's been very limited UK research on this. There has been some. Brown is a notable exception. This Her Majesty's Inspector of Conservatory report was very useful at the time, where we didn't really have body armour and we weren't too sure what equipment we were going to use. So it was useful for that time to bring into play things that we have now. But still, there are only pockets of literature within the UK. Tons of stuff in the USA, and mainly that's to do with fatal woundings and a lot of domestic violence stuff and some really good stuff as well. So there's quite a bit, but the relevance of my study was pertinent to again, another knowledge gap in Merseyside. We've never done a study on it. And obviously we're in this fiscal challenge now, so if your officers are injured, there's two duties there. There's a duty of care in terms of safety, and there's also the duty of care in terms of getting as many officers on the streets as possible. So there were the driving factors to the study. Previous studies, I'll briefly touch on these because of time, but there's some interesting ones as you look back, suggesting that in the 60s, it was almost like a subculture of violence there, which the officers played a part in. This one here, Bailey and Garofalo, this is really important, and I'll come back to that in a second, but it's basically a need to train officers to deal with provocation more. And again, Phillips and Cochrane, 91, identified that those officers who assaulted more seem to have more complaints. Spookily enough, my findings might say something similar to that. So just a very quick context. In the 5 years, we dealt with over 3 million calls for service. Of those, 19% of those calls for service were crimes, so 600,000 just over. Of those crimes, just over 100,000 were violent crimes, and of those violent crimes, police assaults accounted for, 4,545. And interestingly, of that, there was only 1,015 injured officers. And I'll talk about the scale of those injuries in a second. So effectively, you could say that a Merseyside officer is assaulted once in every 672 incidents. So it's not quite as high as you might have imagined. It certainly wasn't as high as I imagined. Some other results. I've already talked about that figure, 58% of Merseyside police. But 35% of the assaulted group are only assaulted once, 55% twice or less in a five-year period. This is where it starts to get interesting for me in the study, because I found 128 officers assaulted five times or more in 5 years. And then startling to me was 31 of those were assaulted nine times or more. It goes on, our top assaulted officer, 21 times in 5 years. We've transferred him to our training unit now to deal with public safety. Things happen. And then three other officers with 17 times each as well. Now, I found that absolutely astonishing, and it was really. And it goes on. I just did a very quick slide here just to let you know what the age, service, and gender findings were. Our force average age is quite high, actually. It's 39 years old, is our average age for a force, because we tend to recruit around the 23, 24 year old mark. And the average service of our force population is 14 years. And the gender mix is 74 male, 26 in terms of a percentage female. The assaulted population, the 2,333, the age comes down then to 32, 11, and again, very similar ratio in terms of male and female gender. But interestingly, when you get to 128 officers, the high end of the assaulted officer range, it drops down to 28 years in terms of an average. But this is the bit, 5 years service, just over 5 years service. Now that is very similar to lots of other studies, particularly in the USA, that have found the same thing. The 31 group, what I call the critical group, again, very low, 6 years. But look at the ratio of female and male officers, there's no real difference. There's no significant difference that my study found in terms of male and females being assaulted. Sorry, there we go. Right, just a couple of other snippets. So I was then interested in how does that correlate to their complaint records? And on average, in our force, you get complained about 1.5 times in 5 years. The 128 officers were four times higher than that, I suppose, or four times more likely. But the 31 officers were seven times more likely to be complained about. Just a little snippet here. Officer number two, who's assaulted 17 times, these are just some things on the file in terms of You know, he's on a live final written warning. Officer number 10 is suspended, awaiting a trial, misconduct hearing. Officer 19 we got rid of. And officer 22, live written warning. What happened with this data? It showed very clearly that when you start at number 21 and you come all the way down to about 128, the complaint ratio and the civil litigation ratio drops in almost in an identical format. So this study of Bailey and Gafforo about officers needing to be trained, there's got to be something in that in terms of their language and how incidents are developing to assaults on them. This, again, is another one from Albert and Dunham, and is a really good study, this, to look at if you ever get a moment. It explains, really, about where we're actors. Police officers become actors, and so do assailants, and, you know, what one expects from the other might not always happen. So, for me, this culminates in better training, which I'll just finish with in a second. The study also produced two things, because a lot of other studies do as well. Patrol, our neighbourhood officers, they account for 67%. Thankfully, not many detectives get assaulted. And thankfully, not many of the rank of sergeants as well, so that's good. Assailants, very similar to other studies, under 25 years of age, and you'd expect that because a lot of criminology, again, has those as the main protagonists. Interestingly, assaults on police account for 73%. These are Home Office gradings. The more serious offences of grievous bodily harm, 1%. This adds up to 101%, actually, because we've rounded up. So any quick mathematicians in the audience, I know. But again, it confirms that the injuries suffered 73% of the time aren't serious, actually more than that. Now, very quickly, just to finish, I did some geographical stuff as well, a bit of hotspot analysis. This is looking by beats, of which there are over 400. I also looked under local super output areas, of which there are 905, to try and get down to that micro place. But it showed the same thing, effectively. And what it showed was, this is where areas are officers are assaulted the most. These are the hotspots. The number one is our nighttime economy area in Liverpool city centre. But all the rest are our custody suites. So there's an issue there in terms of what are we doing when we're supposed to have control of prisoners in our custody suites. So the implications for the study, custody suite review needs to be done, and a lot of training needs to be put into that. There needs to be greater investment in data capture and a better use of our data as well. More effective leadership and management. The previous speaker, I think, articulated much better than I did, you know, the impact of that and what it can actually achieve, and a training review. We've got to train officers under 5 years' service in demanding areas better, with more social skills and more ability to interact and reduce assaults. Thank you. I'll pass over to my colleague.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, Bill, good friend and colleague appearing before me, is evidence in itself that a CBE will always trump rank, and quite rank too. My thesis title is, as before you, Car Key Burglaries and Exploratory Analysis. What I'll try and do in a graveyard shift, the last session, is keep it tight, but try and go through what is a car key burglary, why did I study car key burglaries, how did I go about it, what are the results, and what are some opportunities for future research. Okay, car key burglary basically refers to cars stolen using keys taken during the course of a burglary. It's a relatively new phenomenon. Key date is 1998, where there's a requirement for newly manufactured cars in Europe to be fitted with immobilisers, thereby making it impossible to start new cars without keys. So essentially, as was the wish of the then government, vehicle crime drops, but perhaps a sinister byproduct of that is an increase in cars being taken from during the course of burglaries. So why car key burglary? In 2008, 6% of all burglaries in England and Wales involved the taking of a vehicle. This was referred to in the ACPO National Assessment of Car Key Burglary in 2009. It was referred to as an emerging problem. and highlighted as a strategic risk. It's been highlighted actually by various forces across the country since 2003. It was predicted to continue and actually increase. As evidence of that, if you look at 2010, for Merseyside, over 13% of burglaries in Merseyside were indeed car key burglaries. Going to St Helens BCU, which I'm the area commander for, it was as high as 19%. So what I'm actually saying is almost one in five burglaries in my BCU were car key burglaries. And actually, it's almost an emergence of a phenomenon. I'll skip that, I'll move through stealth, I beg your pardon, through stealth. Because actually, the context is the fact that burglaries are reducing throughout the country, 31.5% in that time period in Merseyside. So actually, it's overall a good news story. So it's probably been missed and seen a bit later than it should have. Also, recording issues, such as the definition, underreporting, intelligence gaps, and limitations, therefore, in the tactical response. Operation Salvo was an operation I was involved in. I'll mention in two slides' time and touch on that. So essentially, limited research with which to attack and tackle this problem. In the words of Alexander Graham Bell, when one door closes, another opens. Unfortunately, quite literally, it is the door to people's homes in this case. And in doing so, it brings together victims and offenders with, unfortunately, sometimes the effects of the gentleman on the right-hand picture. Interesting for criminological theory, particularly rational choice, the idea that offenders are rational decision makers, weighing up the relative risks and rewards of their activity. And here they appear to have gone for the greater of two evils rather than the lesser, from vehicle crime to car key burglary. Operation Salvo is a two-week operation that took place in the third and fourth weeks of January 2010. It was Merseyside's response to significant concerns regarding the emergence of car key burglary late 2009 and into 2010. The list of figures on the left-hand side are basically an extract taken from our daily morning report, which is sent across the force, denoting sort of key operations and incidents, the overnight report. I'm not going to go down the whole list, but basically, as you can see, from the number of arrests in 2 weeks for burglary anomalies, 182, and over 50,000 homes attended to drop letters through, whether the houses were secure or insecure, and incidentally, they were reality checked, indicates the level of activity. Why have I shown that? Well, two reasons. Firstly, to show why it's important to me and why I chose car key burglary. But second, to show that actually, due to our lack of understanding of car key burglaries, it was almost a hammer to crack a nut. It's a great operation, had some great effects, but actually, with evidence, an evidence-based approach, we could have used those resources more clinically. And one example, I've got loads, but one example I'll mention is the issue of trying to create crime corridors. Offender location, offender home base to offence location to actually the dump site. Because the information on the dump sites was either not recorded or it was something like Queen's Drive, which is the circular road around Liverpool, have no use whatsoever. Therefore, the space, the place, and we were trying to sort of police with level two significant resources was too wide than we could have had if we had more information. So the exploratory analysis was basically to understand the nature of car key burglaries, a descriptive analysis, and also comparing the characteristics of the burglary types using an effect size analysis with Cohen's D as the calculation, to try and gain an insight into temporal, geographic, and behavioural and offender-specific aspects of car key burglary, and also highlight differences in the two. The data, I used three combined sets of data, ratings of car and regular burglaries in Merseyside for 2010. Firstly, 1,936 car key and regular burglaries. I actually included robberies where cars were actually taken during the course of a burglary. For instance, burglar goes into a house, uses threats or violence, that's recorded as a robbery, but actually it hides another form of car key burglary, so they were included. Second form of data, 140 offenders who were the subject of a charge or an offence taken into consideration for either type of burglary, and then the 180 unique offences committed by that group of offenders. The results, in terms of temporal analysis, car key burglary more likely at night than regular burglary. You'd expect that. That's when the vehicle's at the address because the occupiers invariably are at home overnight sleeping in the beds. Slight variations in month, day, but no notable differences. In terms of geographical, St Helens and Sefton, the highest proportion of car key burglaries, they are effectively net importers of car key burglary. They're located on the outskirts, the periphery of Merseyside. In terms of offenders, The majority of offenders were both burglary types and male and under 25 years. But actually, for car key burglars, you could take that, constrain it down to the 18 to 24 years age range. In terms of method of offence to gain entry to the building, there are four really to bear in mind here. It's not quite apparent from the bar chart, but in terms of the effect size analysis used to measure the magnitude of the difference between the two burglary types, there are two large effect sizes denoting very strong differences, and they are deception and hook and cane. We'll take deception first. Deception is the idea of stealing from a house through a sneak. No car key burglars use deception. The idea of getting in a car is hardly, it's a bit of a throwaway clue as you drive the car away, so there's hardly anyone being fooled by that activity. Quite obvious. Hook and cane, conversely, very much favoured by car key burglars. The idea you can get into the house, take the keys, and not actually physically go inside the premises, so low risk. So hook and cane, obviously. Medium size effects for force smash window, that was in favour of regular burglary. But actually, conversely, the remove cut door or window, which is a more, if you like, refined way of entering the building, not as much noise, less risk, was favoured by car key burglars. In terms of dwelling types, once again, not that clear from the bar charts, but specifically on the effect size analysis, the ones to bear in mind are flats and semi-detached. Flat was a large effect size, denoting a strong difference between the two burglary types. If you think about it, fender breaks into a flat, picks up the car keys, goes outside, and there's generally there's often a communal car park, so often enhanced by security, so why would they target flats? Harder, more risk. Conversely, if you like, the other side of the coin is the semi-detached house, which is at a medium-sized effect. That would be better for them because invariably the car will be outside the house on the drive. Size analysis here with six dichotomous variables. It's Cohen's D is the calculation, and it's showing the magnitude of the differences between the two burglary types. If you go down the right-hand side on the forest plot to the summary effect size, which is the blue diamond, that's showing a medium-sized effect, which shows there are moderate differences for that basket of dichotomous variables for those two types of burglary. What I'm basically saying is there are actually differences between car key burglary and regular burglary in terms of the characteristics. Going down the individual variables, weapons used is the smallest effect, but actually that was quite a surprise based on the issues that we encountered in late 2009, 2010. Lots of violence or perception of violence. I expected that to be higher. It was smaller, but it still favoured car key burglary. Moving down then, offender not seen, point of entry from the front, and a tidy search of the premises. Probably logical if you think about them. They were all medium-sized effects, all tending towards car key burglary. And then you get into the big effects, the large effects, where there's a very strong difference, a nighttime offence, and the idea of the dwelling being occupied. I suppose those last two go hand in glove. Distance travelled from home base. The median distance travelled was significantly further for car key burglars compared to regular burglars. The median average for car key was 4.9 kilometres. For regular, it's 2.1. Looking at the graph there, the blue as car key burglary, the furthest distance was just about 23.5 kilometres, and the smallest was just over 14.5. I should say that the largest for the regular was just over 14.5 kilometres. This is particularly interesting, really, for Merseyside because it's such a small geographical area. What I tried to do is get data for offences committed by Merseyside offenders outside of Merseyside. I couldn't do that because of the state of the PNC printouts. We gave it up as a bad job. I just couldn't do it. It was taking too much time. That said, I'm very confident that variation will be amplified should I have been able to replicate it outside of the forest boundary. This is the frequency of cars stolen based on manufacturer type. As you can see, Ford and Vauxhall, I'll mention Renault as well, most frequently stolen, but then again, they're the most frequently owned. So basically, that as much use as a chocolate teapot, that slide. And sadly for me, I realised that on the 22nd December, about 2 weeks before I was due to give him a thesis. So at that point, very sadly, just before Christmas, I entered into negotiations with PNC Hendon, asked them would they remove the limiter for the capacity for the postcodes, L postcodes in Merseyside, that would give me ownership 5,000 over, because what they do is they limit it, I think it's from memory, 5,000 plus. So they kindly took pity on my state of affairs, and it would have been around Christmas, that probably gave me the edge as well. and they suspended it for overnight for 2 days, which gave me the opportunity then to get this slide, which is a little bit more meaningful, which shows the rate. The things probably worth pointing out here are that you have your Ford, Volkswagen and Renault moving down to the midterm rates, but actually, as you see, moving to the top five there, you've got Audi, Subaru, BMW, which are probably more associated with performance vehicles, which potentially could be used in further criminality. This is a particularly important slide here, offering this to you, for two reasons. One, don't get an Audi if you live in Merseyside. And secondly, I missed a trip to Sussex over the New Year because of this slide, and my wife will not let me forget it. I can tell you that now. So, very important. So, in summary then, in terms of car key burglary, favoured overnight, 18 to 24-year-old males. In terms of Merseyside, outlying BCUs, which were net importers of car key burglary, that tended to be served best by the fast road network. Hook and cane, remove, cut, door, window techniques favoured. And I have a view on that, really, because I think not only is car key burglary, this is just my view, it's not evidence-based, but not only is car key burglary a higher risk than vehicle crime, I think car key burglary is a higher risk than regular burglary, because once the actual item's taken from inside the premises, i.e. the keys, the offence isn't complete. You have to leave the premises, then you have to find the car, open the car, gauge the engine and drive away. So in doing so, I think car key burglars have gone for lower risk tactics within a higher risk offence. That's my lack of evidence-based take on rational choice theory, potentially. Deception and forced smash window door are more unlikely for car key burglars. Front access to premises. Most people put if you're like me, you put them in your coat or you put them on the table in the hall. Hence the reason why hook and cane is so popular. And it's the smallest amount of distance usually between the driveway and actually the keys themselves. Why go through the second floor window at the back of the premises if you're target specific and you want those keys to take the vehicle? As I say, it's not evidence based; it's just a view. These takes on the various summary aspects. Tidy search. If it's specific for the keys, why search? Once you've got your keys, you're happy with what you've got. You take the vehicle. Occupied premises. That's logical on the basis it's overnight when people are there and the vehicle are there, so that's very logical. Less likely to be seen is interesting, because you're going at a time when people are in the premises. That said, it's potentially compensated by the fact that it's hours of darkness. There's little difference in the aggravated form of offence for both regular and car key, which surprised me slightly, particularly because of the reasons for Operation Salvo, as mentioned earlier. Audi and Subaru, high performance, potentially using further criminality, that's just a view. And the greater distance travels from home-based offence location is interesting, because those kind of distances, to actually go to the location, the offence location, it's too far to walk, really. I can't see the type of people who burgle walking. They're not generally hikers. You can imagine going in another vehicle with company in the vehicle, being dropped off. So actually we're talking about multiple offenders, and thereby, in terms of investigating them further, we're talking about potentially conspiracy offences, phone work, that kind of investigation. Okay, leadership meets evidence-based policing, the other 50%. About 12 years ago, a chief constable who presented here in the previous 2 days of the conference said to me, you get 50% of the marks if you turn up. He or she was referring to leadership as a spontaneous firearms instance when I was a newly promoted police inspector. And they're exactly right. But the other 50% is evidence-based policing, what you do when you get there. If anyone's seen The Outlaw Josie Wales, it's my favourite film. There's a part of the film there where Josie Wales stands just about to have a gunfight, and the Indian that goes around with him, his partner, basically says he's going to fight with the sun at his back, because Josie Wales is looking for an angle. It's an evidence-based angle to win the gunfight. The angle for taking on car key burglary for me are the items just set out in this list here. Developments in criminological theory, how it sits with the theory and the context. More accurate crime recording. We talked about the definition, dump sites and geocoding as examples. Developing the attendant intelligence on the victim offender location. Crime prevention developments. The car industry, can we disable vehicles remotely? More work on export markets, where are the cars going? Fixed site ANPR and multiple offenders, conspiracy investigations, as I've just mentioned. Future research, pushing through this, apologies for the time if I'm going slightly over, but future research, I alluded to in the actual thesis, distance travel from the home base, got to be a must. Multiple offenders, vehicle dump sites and mobility triangles was the source of much frustration for me, because I couldn't take that on during the course of the work. and also the motivations. Is it financial gain, transportation, further criminality? And also it might be worth pointing out that additional items of property were stolen in 67% of the car key burglaries recorded in Merseyside. So it's not just for car keys. So what is their mens rea? Are they specific, or are other items of property taken, are they purely incidental to the primary crime of taking the vehicle? And also situational crime prevention, clearer opportunities in terms of developing that. Final slide. It's not all bad news. In spite of some of the deficiencies, there is some good news. Thank you.